I want to start by showing you about 8 minutes from this film. It's called Jonah Who'll Be 25 in the year 2000, directed by the French director Alain Tanner. Obviously, you could tell from the maths that it was made in 1975. Script by John Berger, who we've been mentioning in the subtext of the module so far. Berger and Tanner were both tremendously interested in Benjamin's ideas about history and cultural production. I hear that the sequence, there are several characters in the film, all of whose names begin with the letter M. And they, the sequence that we're about to see, two of the characters are involved. The main sequence is of a supply teacher at a school who comes in, and it's somewhere between high school and university, so a kind of community college sort of level. But he introduces them to the idea. He teaches history, introduces them to an idea of history, in which I think you'll be able to see or hear Benjamin's views playing themselves out through the sequence. We then cut to a character who is killing time, as it were, and it's a sort of commentary on killing time, on the capitalization of time, on commodification in general. So just let's watch those two sequences.
Jamais. Le boudin se mange avec la purée de pommes. Est-ce que le temps est du boudin? Darwin le croyait. Quoique la nature de la viande changeait d'un bout à l'autre de la saucisse. Marx, lui, pensait qu'un jour, tout le monde s'arrêterait de manger du boudin. Einstein et Max Planck arrachèrent la peau du boudin, qui perdit alors sa forme. De quoi la peau du boudin est-elle faite?
C'est de l'intestin de cochon.
Très bien. Regardons maintenant le boudin qui n'est pas encore coupé. On y voit des plis, des méandres. Et c'est de cela que je veux vous parler. De quoi sont faits les plis du temps? Dans les sociétés agricoles, les hommes croyaient que le temps consistait simplement en cycles, en saisons. Chaque solstice d'hiver contenait le même moment. L'individu devenait vieux, bien entendu, mais c'était simplement parce qu'il s'usait. Il était le combustible qui faisait marcher la machine des saisons. Le capitalisme apportera l'idée du temps autoroute, autoroute du soleil, autoroute du progrès. L'idée du progrès, c'était que les conquérants n'avaient pas simplement gagné une bataille, et qu'ils avaient été choisis et désignés en tant qu'êtres intrinsèquement supérieurs. Leur supériorité devait forcément traverser les cycles et les saisons. Elle les transforma en tire-bouchons, dont eux, les conquérants, étaient la pointe. Et avec cette pointe, ils ouvrirent les unes après les autres les bouteilles des cultures inférieures. Ils burent jusqu'à étancher leur soif et jetèrent les bouteilles en s'assurant bien qu'elles se cassent. Ceci était une nouvelle forme de violence. La flèche ou l'épée avait déjà tué, mais ce qui tuait maintenant, c'était le verdict de l'histoire des conquérants, bien sûr. Avec cette nouvelle violence, arriva une peur nouvelle chez les conquérants. La peur du passé. La peur des inférieurs dans leurs bouteilles cassées. Ah ! Si le passé pouvait un jour rattraper les conquérants, ils montreraient certainement aussi peu de pitié qu'ils n'en avaient montré eux. Au XIXe siècle, cette peur du passé fut rationnellement transformée en loi scientifique. Le temps devint alors une route sans virage. La longueur de la route était une abstraction terrifiante, seulement les abstractions ne se vengent pas. Dès lors, les penseurs du XIXe siècle choisirent la peur de la pensée en éliminant la peur du sauvage et de ses flèches. Et leur route avait des bornes absolument régulières. Des millions d'années divisées en heures, en dates, en jours et en heures de travail à pointer sur la machine à pointer. Comme du boudin. Aujourd'hui, enfin, on voit que l'autoroute du capitalisme s'effondre. Pour plus de raisons que je ne peux vous en dire dans le petit coup de boudin qu'est cette leçon inaugurale. Dans un gland, il y a déjà les méandres qui donneront la forme du chêne. Ce que vous êtes, chacun de vous, était déjà là dans les chromosomes au moment de ma conception. De votre conception. Je ne suis pas un déterministe. Mais dans votre première cellule, il y a un message que vous êtes maintenant en train de lire. Il y a des choses qui font des trous dans le temps. Et les trous s'alignent parfaitement, on peut y faire tracer une brochette. N'oubliez pas que mon père est bouché. Le temps se plie pour que les trous coïncident. Et pourquoi n'est-on jamais prophète en son propre pays? Parce que les prophètes n'arrivent qu'à la moitié des trous. Comme ça. Ils sont entre les temps. Personne ne comprit grand-chose à Diderot jusqu'au moment où une génération entière cria monstre à Freud. Il fallait ce temps-là pour passer au travers du trou. Les trous que font les prophètes pour regarder le futur sont les mêmes par lesquels les historiens lorgnent ensuite vers les vieux meubles du passé. Regardez-les lorgner à travers les trous creusés par Jean-Jacques Rousseau pour nous expliquer le 18e siècle. Regardez vos montres. Oh, c'est l'heure. On va terminer avec le rythme binaire, celui du cœur et des batteurs. Entre chaque coup, il y a du temps. Le temps, c'est le fait de reconnaître que le deuxième coup n'est pas le premier. Le temps est créé par l'opposition. En synthèse, le temps se réduit.
haven't seen it. And you can see, I think, some of the points that that Benjamin is making already, kind of this idea specifically of the holes that need to line up in some sense, and also the idea of looking forwards and looking backwards. There's a great deal to discuss. Here's an artwork by Toshiyuki Kobayashi, which makes some of the connections clear, I think, for us. We have, again, that blood sausage notion, or the ideas of time, holes of time, but note the images of Walter Benjamin there already present for the artist thinking in the same categories and spelling the word aura specifically. The problem for Benjamin is how to write the past. And for Benjamin, it's not possible to do this in any simple or direct way, because the actuality of the past has been occluded or covered over entirely by a certain dominant way of seeing. So what we have to do as historians, he uses the word historian, but he also is speaking of a certain kind of political activist, isn't he? The two come together for him. What we have to do is to recover not only what has disappeared, but also, and this is more difficult, what has been disappeared. It's not only that Benjamin is interested in the things that, as it were, pass out of existence in some way because their time is up, because they elapse, they grow old, or they grow unuseful in some sense and merely disappear. Benjamin is also interested in the idea that that things are murdered out of existence in some way. His idea of history is extraordinarily replete with violence. The extract, I mean, the little essay, if that's what we can call it, on the concept of reading that on the concept of history that we're reading, was never published in his lifetime. It's not clear exactly how he would have presented it and so on. But it's got these snapshots or these fragments, each of which requires a great deal of thinking through. And some of them would require us to do a kind of an archaeological or a Benjaminian kind of act of historicization in order to uncover them. I'm thinking of this first one, for instance, about the puppet wearing Turkish attire with a hookah in its mouth, and the little hunchback dwarf who sits within the magician's machine. There are lots of these machines. If you look at the traveling circuses that would wander around Central Europe, probably in Britain as well, in the 1920s and 30s, very often there would be a magician with a table. The table, of course, would be covered so that you couldn't see it, but inside this table there would be enough space for a small person to hide and levers, and the small person could actually manipulate things on the table while the magician was pretending not to do things. Benjamin is interested, I think, in this motif. He takes it from a very old a fairy story. Brentano collected these. This one, Das Buchlicht Männlein, the little hunchback, and it's a story is always about a figure who goes to do something and finds in some way that it's already done or half done or actually undone. The hunchback has always got there before the child, and the child is unable to complete this task. So when I go into my kitchen, there my soup to make, a little hunchback who's in there, my little pot to break. This particular translation. If we look at an extract from Benjamin's reminiscence, a sort of memoir that he wrote called A Berlin Childhood around 1900. Look how this hunchback figure appears here for him. My mother would say, "Greetings from Mr. Clumsy," when I'd broken something. And now I understand what she was talking about. She was speaking of the little hunchback
And he here quotes from a different translation. When I go up to my kitchen stove to make a little soup, I find a little hunchback there has cracked my little stoop. But he goes on to reflect on this story. The little man preceded me everywhere, coming before he barred the way, but otherwise he did nothing more to me than exact the half part of oblivion from which from each thing to which I turned. And that idea of the half part of oblivion, an extraordinary phrase, and we have to think in a Benjaminian way, I think, to get hold of that. It was always he who saw me. He saw me in my hiding places and before the cage of the otter. Again, something that we have to uncover, I think, the cage of the otter. I'm not sure that children keep otters anymore, but that sense of winter morning and by the telephone in the pantry, on the Brauhaus bag with its butterflies, and on my skating rink with the music of the brass band, he has long since abdicated. Dear little child, I beg of you, pray for the little hunchback too. So the sense of the hunchback as somebody who is both blocking access to the past, but also the keeper in some ways of store of memories which have to be recovered. It's so striking in Benjamin's writing here, which rather like Proust, if you think of remembrance of things past in Proust, where the evocation of the Madeleine. It drives the narrator on a series of memories which recover so many things. What exactly is memory in its relationship to the past? These are some of the questions that Benjamin is asking. I'm thinking of Thesis 6. So here. Every age must strive anew to wrest tradition away from the conformism that is working to overpower it. The Messiah comes not only as the Redeemer, he comes as the victor over the Antichrist. The only historian capable of fanning the spark of hope in the past is the one who's firmly convinced that even the dead will not be safe from the enemy if he's victorious, and the enemy has never ceased to be victorious. We've got this concatenation, don't we, here of the idea of revolution and the messianic, the end of time, the moment at which the Messiah enters, which is also, of course, the end of time, which is in some senses how Marx represented the idea of revolution. Revolution certainly is the end of a certain kind of history. It's the moment of the birth of a new kind of history. So Benjamin is struck by the fact that after, for instance, the French Revolution, so many people in France began talking of year zero. The idea of a time which starts again in some ways. The old order is completely collapsed. In some way, a new order comes, and his notion is here. But notice this idea of it's very striking, fanning the spark of hope in the past. It's as though the past has been obliterated, as it were. Fires have started. It's been burnt out. Maybe just some embers are still there. And in some sense, the historian has to look back. And fan the sparks of hope in the past. So you're looking at the past for what exactly? And it seems as though, I mean, this concept of hope is crucial. It seems as though what Benjamin wants us to do is, Habermas, when he writes about Benjamin, uses a phrase, anamnestic redemption. Anamnestic is looking past, but redemption. How does one redeem the past? And in some way, of course, that's what it's what revolution aims to do. I can give the only example that I can give that might be meaningful of this is the way in which at the moment of decolonization in so many of the third world countries, so that there would be this tremendous struggle, sometimes an armed struggle. Many people died on the way. Brutality of colonialism, and then there would be this astonishing ceremony at the end, at which famously it would happen at midnight, that the Union Jack would be lowered,
And then there would be darkness in the national stadium, and in the darkness the new flag of the new country would come up, and then the new leader would stand up to speak. And the new leader would tend always, whether that figure was Nehru, or whether it was Kwame Nkrumah, or whether it was Sukarno, whoever we're talking about, that figure would stand up and speak and would say something about, I don't know, let's use Nkrumah's address this is March the 6th, 1957 in Ghana, and he says, at long last, Ghana is free. And then he goes on to talk about all of the struggles, the people who have lost their lives, and he names the students and the women who worked in the fields, and he names the soldiers, and he names the fighters. And there's a sense in which all of those people who have fallen in the long road, what you see him doing is constructing the history of this moment, setting up the lines, as it were, creating the holes through which that time, in some ways, that time which was for the people who died along the way, it seemed to be a story of defeat. And he transforms it into a kind of narrative which leads to this moment. Ghana's freedom, as though it all led to that particular point in some way. He's constructing a narrative. You could argue that he's fanning the sparks of hope in the past. But Benjamin is concerned not simply with the largest kinds of things, with the idea of political freedom and so on. He's interested also in the fact that people with their little hopes, as it were, their little dreams. If you think of what's involved, let's say, in being killed in a road accident, you don't know that that's going to happen to you. So you have all of your thoughts with you as you walk out into the road before being killed. And what is the historian's responsibility to those thoughts, which are thoughts of futurity, among other things, thoughts of what you're going to go on to do, and of course, which you never do because you die. And does the historian have a responsibility to those thoughts? Is the historian, in some sense, the custodian of those small hopes in some way? I think this is partly what Benjamin is driving at. And we notice, of course, that those who dominate, those who win the wars of various kinds, are the people who speak that enemy has never ceased to be victorious. Even the dead will not be safe from the enemy if he is victorious, says Benjamin. Again, we hear this language in Benjamin of tremendous urgency, but this idea that even the dead won't be safe, because by and large, tradition is not interested in the stilled or the stillborn hopes of those who have died, precisely because it seeks to establish uniformism, a uniform on those. I mean, look, for instance, at this Ferris, a 1932 painting of the first Thanksgiving, 1621, and think of the go back to that Benjaminian. This enemy has never ceased to be victorious, etc. You can see very simply here the strict inversion. And so here it is, the pilgrims giving food to the Native Americans, which of course beggars belief in one sense. After all, it was they who arrived in the Americas and who were starving. They who were provided food by the Native Americans. But we notice also the way in which racial relations are already encoded into the 1621 picture. So the kneeling figure, that woman being escorted to the feast by a Puritan woman in the back, and notice the sort of the body postures there, the question of racial supremacy and so on. So this sense of this representation of the first, that this is tradition making, isn't it? It celebrates tradition, but in celebrating tradition, you can see what it does with the past. It murders the dead again, as it were. It actively forgets. It doesn't just forget, it actively forgets. And this, I take it, is what Benjamin is driving at. His essay is directed centrally towards the consideration, I think, of two mutually entailing questions. The first is about remembering, and the second is about forgetting. So if we think about what has been forgotten and how and why, those are Benjamin's questions. The question about remembering raises for him the ideas of justice and of redemption. Why do we remember the vanquished past? Why do we remember, why do we want to remember the past of the vanquished? And we can see that remembering the past of the vanquished isn't just a matter here of as it were, lifting off a veil. You can't say, let's tell this person's story, because we see that person's story is occluded by this representation. And that person's story is not simply not told, it's impossible to tell it from that representation. That story covers over the past of that figure. You can't just reach in, grab it and say, now let's have your story because we haven't had it before. It is obliterated in that narrative. Benjamin famously says that there is no document of culture, in other words, a work of art or something like this, which is not at the same time a document of barbarism. Extraordinary formulation. I'm thinking here of the Terracotta Warriors. Truly, how many people have been to Xi'an to see the Terracotta? Has anyone? Only me then. So that it's a quite extraordinary. As you know, they've uncovered something like, I don't know, 8 mountains out of about 75 or something. So something which took millions of people 30 years to construct. This one particular emperor, the same emperor who built the Great Wall, who was afraid in dying that he was going to go into the afterworld alone, and therefore needed to recreate in his sarcophagus an entire universe of warriors who could protect him. And the warriors, of course, needed themselves to have their families with them, their pets, their cattle, their weapons. And so this huge army of carpenters, craftsmen, and so on was recruited to produce these life-size warriors. Sorry, that was a different image. Life-size warriors, all of whom with all the ranks observed and so on and so forth. It's an astonishing document of culture in some sense, but also a document of barbarism. You think of the number of people killed in the process. Actually, as you know, in the building of the wall, the Great Wall, thousands of people who died in the process were simply absorbed into the concrete of the wall. They're still there, their bones. So this literally is a monument of barbarism as well as of culture. I did have that other image just to sort of because of what is suggested here about the relationship of an overpowering authority to the ability to mobilize and to discipline to trample on the hopes of, as it were, vast numbers of people there. I think also then of just within the British Museum, the Benin bronzes on the left, the Elgin marbles on the right, obviously stripped from their places of origin, brought for display in the British Museum. Documents of culture, documents of barbarism, the duality of that moment. What you can say is that despite official views to the contrary, this isn't how societies remember, but how they forget, it would seem. To remember, what is it to remember on the basis of tradition? If you think of of let's say Morris dancing, or you think of the maypole, or you think of what it is that gets celebrated in folk music, etc. What do we remember there? Isn't remembering the same thing as a kind of forgetting at this point? Traditions are always selective, and traditions often memorialize and euphemize violence. They find ways of encoding violence. One of the ways I've found most useful myself in working through Benjamin's ideas on history is Francis Barker's work. Barker was my teacher at MA level at Essex back in the late 70s, died himself in, I think, around 2000 or so, but wrote a fabulous book called The Tremulous Private Body, which was an attempt at Foucauldian kind of work on early 17th century. That's what he worked on. And then this work called The Culture of Violence. And here he is thinking, he talks a lot in his work about, as he's working on Shakespeare and the Jacobeans particularly, he talks about, in some ways, how difficult it was for him to do the research. Because the 17th century was, and the 16th also, but particularly the 17th, a century of tremendous fear and terror. This was the moment in Western Europe in which something like the modern state form flexed its muscles, and with devastating consequences for people, local people everywhere, who were often found themselves on the wrong side of these new normative structures. Get to work at a certain time, dress in a certain way, don't be drunk, perform in this particular way, as a logic of capitalist performance, if you like, was imposed on what was earlier there. Forms of unruliness and what then got defined as perversity were ruthlessly punished. And Barker was particularly interested in that, in doing the work in the archives, so that the number of people literally killed was something he found quite difficult. So he says that a society that loses its memory is inevitably engaged in violence. Reciprocally, a society shot through with violence either loses its memory or is caught up in a problematization of memory, which suggests that the order and continuity of memory at the sovereign level offers to apparently to preserve are themselves in fact violences and forgettings. If you have a look at the handout that I distributed, which is a recent very mainstream report on attempts to forget, attempts to remember, that is to say, that are currently going on in Eastern Europe throughout. What we're talking about here specifically is two things. The one is how the Holocaust specifically is to be remembered in these societies, and secondly, how socialism or socialisms, let me say, are to be remembered in them. And some of these societies, of course, have very long histories of socialist government or of socialist rebellion or socialist activism in some cases. I think I mentioned last week that Lukács was active in the Hungarian Communist Party, or Socialist Party, which actually came to power in Hungary very briefly in 1918. Well before the Second World War, there was workerist or socialist or in various ways progressive forms of upheaval, rebellion, discourse throughout Europe, throughout the 20th century. After 1945, of course, with the settlement between East and West, an official communist government was established. Which took the form increasingly of a dictatorship. And so the sense is that in 1989, when communism fell, quote unquote, what was celebrated or what was remembered or what was thought by the people in those places was a liberation from communism. But how is the long history of communism or of socialism in these places. Communism doesn't start in Poland in 1945. You could say it goes back to peasant uprisings, some of which are already active in the 14th century. So what one finds, of course, is initially something of a dispute between Western Europe and Eastern Europe about this. As these new countries are incorporated into the European Union following 1989, initially the Western discourse, which has a certain line on the Holocaust, for instance, on remembrance and so on, it begins to be established as European policy. The Holocaust needs to be remembered. It's specifically something that has to do with the murder of 6 million Jews, etc., etc., and so on. Increasingly in Eastern Europe, however, a different discourse emerges, and it's an extraordinary one, in which fascism, that is to say Hitler, is understood as the enemy of the Eastern European peoples. The Jewish question disappears entirely from the narrative. Absolutely, entirely, in the case, for instance, of the Remembrance Museum, which was established in Lithuania in the 1990s, and which talked about the suffering of Lithuanian people under the fascists and then under the Soviet system after 1989, but made no reference to the Jews. So what we're talking about in these days are the way in which the new populist governments of Poland, of Hungary, of Lithuania, of Latvia, are actively retelling the past and then, as it were, re-murdering sets of people across. So not only, let's say, the 6 million Jews of whom we could speak, who are re-murdered and being forgotten, as it were, but also the sense in which, what about those Poles, those Latvians, those Lithuanians? We're not talking about the collaborators with fascism, because that story is now no longer told. It isn't the case, for instance, that in Hungary a group of people took the opportunity to seize power and collaborate with the Germans. That's no longer, in fact, the leader of that collaboration movement is now described as a great statesman. So that's not the case. But meanwhile, all of the Lithuanians, all of the Latvians, all Poles, all Hungarians are said to have suffered under Nazi persecution, and then Nazi persecution is exactly the same thing as Soviet persecution. You can hear, as syllabuses are being, syllabi are being torn up, different syllabi are being put in place. School children are being taught. New crimes are being established. It's now a crime in many of these countries to say, punishable by prison, to say that many Hungarians were socialists, which seems extraordinary. So these things up here. I mean, you can think of the particular situation of Lukács here. Because Lukács was both a Marxist, Hungarian, both a Marxist and a Jew. so the attempt to come to terms with Lukács' legacy in Hungary is quite peculiarly complicated. Is he regarded simply as a non-Hungarian? Is he a rootless cosmopolitan? I mean, we find the recurrence of that kind of old anti-Semitic language. This description. So in 2010, Lithuania amended its criminal code to punish with up to 2 years in prison those who deny or grossly underestimate the genocides committed by Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union against Lithuanians. So in other words, you hear there the genocide committed specifically against Jews is overwritten. And so on. Earlier this month, Latvia bestowed financial benefits on all World War II veterans, including SS volunteers, etc. Ukrainian parliament, and so on. It's worth reading, I think. We must understand remembrance, I think, as a future-oriented imaginative practice that draws its inspiration from the gesture of solidarity with those trampled by the enemy. remembrance is a matter of anamnestic redemption. Let me just say that again, that sense of the that remembrance draws its inspiration from the gesture of solidarity with those who have died, who have been trampled. How does one then express solidarity? Let's think of your writing, let's say, about poor people in a village in 1916 or 1935 or whatever it is that you're looking at. What is your gesture of solidarity with them as a historian? And you can see that it's not simply a matter, it's not a matter of grand politics for Benjamin. It's not a matter of socialism or something else. It's a matter of actually of the fine grain of their lives. That sense of what were their small hopes, their desires, what were their fears, what were they experiencing in their day to day? Because those are the things that you have to keep alive, he suggests. You have to have solidarity with them. You, and for Benjamin, this is almost a tremendous ethical burden that he wants to take up. They're dead, and tradition is not remembering these things. You have to remember these things, because if you don't remember them, they will disappear forever. Only you can remember them, and by remembering them, you create this. You create a thread which stretches forward into the future. You're not going to change the world by your remembrance, but perhaps at some point the world will be changed. We have to imagine, says Benjamin. It's as though we have to think of this armed with the idea or with the idea around us that every moment, and this is such a strange phrase, every moment is shot through with chips of messianic time. Every moment is the moment at which the Messiah could break through the continuum of history and reorder time. And we, as it were, for Benjamin, we have to be seen to be, we have to be on the side of the Messiah at that moment. Our little labors as historians have to, in some sense, be something that the Messiah can use, that revolution can use in some way. That's Benjamin's conception of history. It's an extraordinary pregnant notion shot through with these tremendous poetic images. I remember I was in the States when I was first trying to grapple with this idea of shot through with chips of messianic time. This notion of the time of the now, the Jetztzeit, as a time shot through with chips of messianic time. So we have the dailiness, but in our dailiness, these hopes, these things which shoot forward like rays of light are when he says they're shot through with chips of messianic time, obviously he's meaning that the light represented by the skewer that the historian tells, can shine through them in some ways. But when I was trying to think of it, I couldn't understand what he meant by shot through with chips of messianic time. What I could think of actually was the notion of chips, when he meant like a chocolate chip cookie. And I kept thinking, what does he mean, shot through with chips of messianic? Were they little nuggets of chocolate? And it's not that, I think. It's more like it's those holes that were introduced there in the film, or the lines through, the things which line up. So in some sense, what our job to do is to line things up, and so on. I think that's the image that's being described. Here's Habermas talking about anamnestic redemption. The injustices perpetrated on the poor by the rich can't be undone, but at least they can be virtually reconciled through remembering, he says. The solidarity can only be engendered and made effective by remembering. This is that notion that there's a secret agreement, says Benjamin, between past generations and the present one. Our coming was expected. We've been endowed with a weak messianic power, a power to which the past has a claim. That claim can't be settled cheaply. This is where the ethical dimension comes in, that as it were, these people are relying on us, that nobody else is telling their truth. Nobody else is... Nobody else wants to reclaim or redeem their lives in some way. For tradition or for power, as Benjamin understands it, they are dead and can be forgotten. Nothing further has to be said, or no use has to be made of them. Going back to Francis Barker. So, in defense of property and the established social order, the Elizabethan and Jacobean crown killed huge numbers of people. So their names not wholly unknown, the circumstances of their demise often recorded, the sheer number of them estimable. Men, women, and children in Shakespeare's England were strung up on permanent or makeshift gallows by hemp and noose. Sometimes the spinal cords snapped at once, or they hung by their necks until they suffocated or drowned, until their brains died of hypoxia, or the shock killed them, pissing and shitting themselves, bleeding from their eyes, thinking. And he talks a lot about this, of going into the archives and finding this, the evidence of this. And what is the historian to do, particularly what is the literary critic, as it were, to do with an interest in Shakespeare? Because in Shakespeare there is extraordinary violence. Francis is working particularly on Titus Andronicus, for instance. Probably the most violent, the body count rivals any kind of contemporary Hollywood film. But for Barker, the violence in Shakespeare euphemizes this set of practices. It's taken elsewhere, or it does something specific. As he says at one point, I'm suggesting that even when violence is occluded, that occlusion is more than a mere lack of ostentation. This formula where he's talking about his own work. Power is not made visible by Titus. At best it leaves complex, oblique, easily unnoticeable traces as the signs of its occlusion. This, of course, brought him into conflict with many of the Shakespeareans who wanted to argue wanted to make a defense of Shakespeare, often setting Shakespeare apart from the other dramatists who they saw as being subject to Barker's critique, and so on. But where he says that, that there's nothing that I or anyone else can do for the dead of early modern England other than to remember in the practical, active, historically redemptive sense that Benjamin recommended. That sense of, so this attempt to describe these people at the point of their death. To me, it's not only the use of the shocking words, pissing, shitting, which is, of course, is already quite shocking, but it's what follows that, thinking. That's what kills me every time I read it, that notion of there they were, thinking, and what is the relationship between us and their thoughts? Because their thoughts are not recoverable. The fact of their death is, we know how they die, at least most of them. We know how Jews were exterminated in the camps, etc., etc. We know how, all in these ordered societies we live, we know the facts, the statistics about how most people fail, succumb, etc., etc. But that particular sense of keeping faith with them in their active, forward-looking activities, that's what he seems to suggest. That part of the present which we call the past flashes up at a moment of danger, Benjaminian concept, it flashes up at a moment of danger. The moment of danger is the moment when tradition or something like a narrative threatens to just overpower it, to make it disappear once and for all. This truly astonishing, the one where he introduces the angel of history. Of course, that's the clay painting which he had in his possession. When you read this, I don't know if any of you went to look at the clay, but when you read this, when I first saw that image, because I read it before we could do these things on Google. In fact, it was probably about the time that clay was still alive. I had no idea that it would look like that. When I saw the way it looked, it shocked me. I wasn't expecting anything like that to be it. I'm not sure how that's how I would describe it. His eyes are wide, his mouth is open, and so. But it's an extraordinary image of he's being blown, where a chain of events appears before us. We see, as it were, because we tell history in sequence, in narrative ways, like the beads of a rosary, one damn thing after another, tragedy, tragedy, tragedy. For those of us, you know, on the progressive end of the social spectrum, this is a horrible time to be alive. You know, defeat, 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 everywhere we look, as it were. So one single, he sees one single catastrophe, but we see a chain of events. It keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls at his feet. He's facing backwards. I mean, he's being blown. A storm is blowing from paradise. He can't close them. The storm drives him irresistibly into the future. So he's looking back at the past. But he wants to stay, to awaken the dead. He wants to redeem this heap of catastrophes in some way. He wants to turn them into that narrative of redemption. How does one do that? And so this is just this particular image of the angel of history that he—it's so enigmatic. I mean, one could spend months thinking about this, or years, indeed, as people have done. But only time here just to mention it. Right, let me stop at that point. I'm plenty to talk about, I think, in seminar. Would you come to seminar with? Perhaps with one of the fragments that you want us to talk about. Just some thoughts about that particular fragment, and let's start the seminar with those.